So if I can just remind, well, those of you who've been at some of the earlier lectures, the theme of these six lectures is the claim that there are certain capacities that language does not presuppose. In other words, language could come into existence without these capacities being present in the language users. But these capacities, not being presupposed by language, are still capacities, so I argue, that can be brought on stream by language. So I argue that any creatures like us otherwise, mentally, in terms of mutual reliance and so on, would be, if they had language, would actually be led into developing and exercising these capacities that I've been characterizing. So the first three capacities were the capacity for judgment, as I call it, the capacity for reasoning, and the capacity for a certain sort of consciousness in perception. So language, the claim is, catalyzes, so to speak, those capacities. Now, I didn't argue, though I've gone close to arguing or suggesting, that it's impossible that creatures without language should have the capacities. The main claim is simply that language precipitates or catalyzes, pretty close to ensures the development of these capacities. Now, in the remaining three lectures on commitment, personhood, and responsibility, I think everybody will admit there's going to be no problem about arguing that these are not presupposed by language. I think it's perfectly conceivable that you should have language, like everyone would see. You could have language amongst creatures who do not have these particular three capacities. But it's still worth arguing, that's what I'm going to try to argue, that the availability of language will, with these two, explain why those capacities would emerge. Now, in arguing in the first three lectures, I depended on what I call a genealogy, a thought experiment about creatures who develop language, and trying to argue that such creatures would more or less, emphasize less, inevitably develop those three capacities. I don't really need that genealogy for the next three, but I'm still going to stick broadly with it. I'm going to talk about we, the protagonists in this story, and so on. But you assume about these that we, the protagonists, do actually have the capacity to make judgments and thereby to decide to make up our minds, say, in belief about whether P or not, and thereby decide to form a belief on a given issue by making a judgment on the issue, that we can reason and that we can have this special sort of perceptual consciousness I talked about the last day. So I'm going to start out. What I'm going to argue today is that language will make it possible for these creatures also, for us if you like, to make commitments in a distinctive sense, and I think a very important sense that is central to human life. And I think that it's the capacity to make commitments in that sense that enables us to, as I'm going to put it, commune and incorporate, to form community in a very distinctive way. That's going to be the second half of the lecture. Okay, so these creatures, we, the protagonists, as I put in the handout, we're presumed to be, as I've argued before, dependent on one another, reliant on one another, because we must be able to rely on one another in order to look after our own ends, whatever they are, even short of forming common ends. And equally, we must be able to get others to rely on us. This is a very important feature of the creatures I'm imagining, and that corresponds, of course, with the natural history of our species, because almost all commentators insist that that's a central aspect of things. Now, if we are mutually reliant in that way, it's going to be important for us to be able to communicate to one another that we have congenial attitudes, that we have beliefs in common with the others, that we have desires, values to interpret, to anticipate later lecture, in common with one another's and so on, to build that sort of community. So how might we do that? Well, one way in which we might do that, this is going to be a dead end, as it were, but it's important to mention it. One way in which we might try to do that is to report on our own attitudes in the way in which, in the story told so far, we report on conditions in the environment. So just as we report on to pick a sort of image of these people. We report on where the fish are running, where the fruit is ripening, where the deer are to be found, whether there's a storm in prospect or whatever, just on, as we report on matters like that where the data are available. So we might think that, well, we should report to one another on what we believe and on what we desire, for example, what we prefer, what we intend, in order to establish this sort of mutual reliability, or at least to facilitate it. But there's a problem if we were to rely in that way on reporting our attitudes, and that's the following. With a report, any report, let's take a report in the environment, there are two sorts of excuses which any one of us is likely to try to make if we prove unreliable. It's going to be important to us for reputation's sake, if only for reputation's sake, that we do actually establish we're reliable with others. And if I, for example, with a view, mislead you in some way, I tell you the fruit is ripening on the hill to the southeast, and you go there and complain to me that it's not, well, one sort of excuse I might give is that, you know, the evidence was misleading. I was sure I saw that red glow, you know, associated with ripening fruit and so on. But on the other hand, of course, it was early morning and dusk is and dawn is like that. So, and you might accept that excuse, in which case I'm let off the reputational hook. You don't, as it were, oust me from the reliance circle if you accept that excuse. Well, another sort of excuse I might say is, well, you know, it was there this morning. Your complaint, I suppose, in this case, is that the fruit's all gone. There is no fruit there. Obviously, someone took it since I saw it. So the evidence has shifted, so to speak. It's not a dated report. And the evidence has shifted. So you, in that sense, try to excuse my having misled you as well. And again, I may offer backup for that explanation. And it's an explanation that gets me off the reputational hook. In that sense, it's an excuse. Now, if I'm just reporting on my mental states to you in trying to establish that we are of a relatively congenial kind and that I in particular am, it's pretty clear that I'll always be able to say, if I don't then act as if I had the attitude that I've reported myself as having, I said, you know, I have a strong belief that, say, Jones is trustworthy, I tell you. And then you find me not actually acting as if Jones was trustworthy, and you complain to me that I've misled you about my attitude, my belief about Jones. I must say, if I'm really reporting, as in to emphasize the report, I might be saying, yeah, I think, I'm pretty sure I believe he is trustworthy. I might say an excuse that the evidence was misleading. Actually, I must have gotten myself wrong. I really thought I believed that. If it were just a report, you could always use that excuse. Or, of course, you might use the excuse that you changed your mind since I spoke to you, that I decided he's not actually trustworthy after all. Change of mind. I might try to back that up. Again, either of these might get you off the hook if they truly are just reports you're giving. Now, that's a problem, of course, because if I can get off the hook that easily, then my words are very cheap. And it would be nice if my words were more expensive, so to speak, so that you could actually rely on them. You know, well, he says he believes this, he says he desires that, but, you know, what the hell? I mean, he can get off the hook any time by claiming a misleading mind or a changed mind. Okay, that might seem to be a real problem, but then you, of course, we've been talking about this before. There is another way in which I might communicate what I believe. So, for example, you ask me whether I think the fruit is ripening, and I say, the fruit is ripening. In other words, I make a judgment about the content of the belief I've been asked about. I just simply say, the fruit is ripening. Now, in virtue of the earlier argument about judgment and belief, by making a judgment, which I take to be speech-dependent, it's the sort of thing you get to do insofar as you learn language, by making a judgment, you manifestly, as I put it, more or less, that's why I have the little tilde before ensure, more or less ensure, or I should say do, I more or less ensure that I have that belief. I've, as it were, made up my mind when saying, is it? Yeah, yeah, the fruit is ripening. Okay, now, Gareth Evans taught us long ago, actually, as it asked before him, that one way, and perhaps the normal way in which we actually communicate what we believe about something is in that mode. In other words, you ask me, do I believe that P, that's about me, and I answer P, which is actually not answering your question, is it? It's making a judgment that P, but as he said, that is a standard way of communicating that actually you believe that P, because you wouldn't have said it unless you believed it. And we have a nice argument for that by the manifest connection that I argued for in the first lecture between judgment and sincere saying and serious saying that something is the case and actually having the belief. So there's another way in which I might communicate the judgment. And here's a really nice thing about it, is that how do I know what it is that I believe? Well, if I make up my mind, as I do in judgment, manifestly ensuring that I have the belief, if I make up my mind, then I have a maker's knowledge, as I called it, of what I believe. I don't have to rely on introspection. You know, do I believe that Jones is true? Do I? No, I'm not sure. Do I? You know, if the data are there, and I think about it, and I say, yeah, Jones is trustworthy, I've made up my mind, and that ensures that I have the belief, and I know, as someone who's just made up his or her mind, that's about the argument of the last lecture, I know that I have that belief. So now that means that when it comes to, I want to communicate, say, focusing on belief, my beliefs to you, in the case where at least the data permit it, I can communicate my beliefs to you by means of making those sorts of judgments. And here's the nice thing. I have a motive, as I said, for making my words more expensive rather than less expensive, so that I can't get off the hook. And the thing about communicating the belief in that way is that I am able to, as it were, shut down the misleading mind excuse. Because I know I have the belief that Jones is trustworthy, having just formed it, and I know it not on the basis of introspective evidence, you know, looking into my mind, I know it by having made up my mind. But that means I can be sure pretty well, of course, never 100% maybe, but I'm pretty sure that I have that belief. And so I can communicate that I have that belief to you in a way that manifestly denies me the later excuse should I prove not to act according to that belief. It shuts down the later possible excuse, gee, I must have gotten my mind wrong. You know, you can say to me, you know, I told you Jones is trustworthy and I don't act as if he is, and you complain to me. I can't say, yeah, that's really interesting. I must have gotten my mind wrong. That suggests that I introspected, found the evidence, and was misled by it. But actually, given I just made up my mind, I have a maker's knowledge of what I believe. And so I can be confident enough about what I believe to be able to communicate it to you in a way that renounces what I call here excuse A. That's the misleading mind excuse. Of course, if I don't act as if Jones is trustworthy, while I won't now be able to say, gee, I misread my mind, I will still be able to say, if I can back that up, that actually I changed my mind about Jones. I used to think he was trustworthy when I spoke to you, I changed my mind. I still have that excuse available of these two salient excuses, but I don't have the first. That means, of course, that communicating what I believe to you by means of a judgment of that kind is more expensive, because I've denied myself an exit, you know, from an embarrassing predicament in the event of not behaving as if I had that belief. I've denied myself the misleading mind excuse while keeping open the other changed mind excuse. So that means I have a motive, of course, to make my words expensive. I have a means of doing so, like a judgment, that P, in communicating that I believe that P, and I now have the confidence required to be able to do that because I've made up my mind. It's not just by scanning my mind that I know what I believe. So I think this is what I call avowing a belief. Rather than reporting the belief, which keeps open the two excuses, I'm going to use the word avow and say that when I communicate a belief, say the P, by avowing the belief, that means I do it by saying P. And avowal in that sense seems to answer on the face of it to the desire to make my words expensive. At least it does so on one condition. You have to add, philosophy is never easy, so you have to add another condition. And the condition is that the belief that you've avowed, the P in question, is the sort of belief where it's going to be pretty obvious from your action whether or not you actually have that belief. Of course, with some beliefs, it's not going to be all that clear from your behavior whether or not you had that belief. For example, if you report a belief that you think it's 0.65, you know, probable that such and such, well, you know, you don't behave as if such and such. You can always say, well, you know, I just said it was 0.6 probable. I didn't say it was such and such. So you can get off the hook. It's not a behaviorally testable belief. And not always. I mean, there are many contexts where it will be, but not always. And the belief, so to speak, that you avow will be expensive. The avowal will be expensive. And therefore, the avowal as communication will be more credible because more expensive, at least when it comes to behaviorally testable beliefs of that kind. Okay, so that means that really in these cases, when you avow a belief, you're really betting on yourself, you know, to actually act as if the content of the belief is true. It is literally like casting a wager. You're sort of saying, okay, take me on. I'm telling you, P, so you can treat me as if I believe that P. And it's expensive because, while I can have maybe the change mind excuse, and of course there are other excuses I might avail myself of too, I can't at least have that excuse. And that will give my words greater credibility. Now, I want to suggest in the next move that avowal is so attractive to us protagonists and to us human beings as we are, it's so attractive to us that we should make our words expensive in that way and credible in that way, that I think avowal is likely to become the default. We're likely to move into, so to speak, an opt-out system, so that when I use words to communicate my belief, the assumption is going to be that I am avowing it in the sense that I am renouncing the excuse if I should prove not to act as if I had the belief. I'm renouncing the excuse of saying, gee, I must have gotten myself wrong. Now, if that's true, if it comes the default, the idea is this, that your words, my words, are always assumed to involve that sort of betting on myself, to involve an avowal, to involve the renunciation of the misleading mind excuse. But I can opt out of the default. I can sort of say, you ask me if I believe Jones is trustworthy. Look, here's the truth. I'm not so sure. You know, and now I begin to report, right? I say, yeah, I sort of think he's trustworthy. I think he's trustworthy, rather. I think I have that belief. But, you know, I'm really, I don't know. I just don't know my own mind. Now, we do that on occasion. We do opt out. But short of going to that trouble, I think we, and I think these protagonists intelligibly, would make avowal the default, you know. So you'd have to opt out in order to be taken to make a report. The normal assumption would be that you're making an avowal and that you're, as it were, how do you put it? You're putting your money where your mouth is, or your mouth where your money is. You know, you're actually putting something at risk. Now, I want to suggest... the same may well be true, and I have to do this briefly because I want to get through probably too much material for a single lecture, but I think that something similar may well be true and is likely to be true with desire, at least on an assumption that I'm going to make and not, unfortunately, defend. Of course, there'll be a means of now avowing a desire, say avowing a preference, avowing an intention, at the limit of desire, so to speak. There'll be means of doing so if the default is that when I communicate my attitudes, I'm actually avowing them, I'm not keeping open the misleading mind excuse. There'll be a motive for avowing my preferences and intentions rather than, you know, just reporting them, which is that it'll make me more credible, make the words more costly. Can I have the confidence to know what I desire and the way in which I was required to have the confidence to know what I believe in order to communicate to avow a belief? Well, I think yes, on the following assumption. If you assume that whenever I desire something, prefer one scenario to another, or indeed intend in the sense of choosing one act option over another or set of other act options, if you assume that in all such cases, there are features of the alternatives in question that make them relatively attractive to me, that I'm aware of these features, they're what I concentrate on as we're making a judgment about how present they are, and that I can make a judgment as to, well, this alternative is more attractive in terms of those features than that alternative, then by knowing, by making that desiderative judgment that this is more attractive than that, it has features that make for attraction in general with me, score higher than that, I will thereby normally form a desire. It'll be a sort of fault in me functionally as an agent if, having identified features that make this more attractive than that, I'm not attracted more to it. Of course, I can make mistakes. Remember, even in judgment, I can judge that something and fail to believe it, like my example of coming to believe that the gambler's fallacy is a fallacy. And then being led to, in the casino, you don't behave, you fall for the fallacy. You bet on black after a run of reds or whatever. The belief doesn't catch, as I said, despite the judgment, despite the sincerity and so on of the judgment. Equally, I may judge that something is more attractive than that. And I mean in terms of, now, purely personal features, we're not talking moral attraction or anything. I may make a correct judgment of that kind, and there may also be the sort of failure. Impulse or whatever, as we know, can block the connection between that judgment and desire, as it can block the connection between judgment and belief. But in general, you would expect creatures of the kind we're talking about, otherwise they won't rely on one another, to come to desire those things in accordance with their judgments of the relative appeal in terms of these accepted desiderata. Now, that being the case, I think I can have not only a motive and a means of communicating while renouncing the misleading bad excuse, my desires, I can also have the confidence enough to be able to do that. Now, both of these cases, we grant me that we can avow, are these creatures, we the protagonists can avow both our beliefs and our desires, make our words more expensive, gain greater credibility from others. They're both instances of what I want to call commitment. We commit to these attitudes, we commit to these beliefs and to these desires when we have confidence enough to be able to communicate them in that way. What do I mean by commitment? All I mean is commitment in the pure game theory sense. You know, in game theory, the notion of a pre-commitment is Galen wants to know, am I going to do something or stick by him in a difficulty? And I say, look, I'm going to give $100 to our mutual friend, John, and if I let you down, you can have that $100. Otherwise, I take it back. I make it expensive to let him down. That's the game theory sense of commitment, or pre-commitment as it's often called. What I'm talking about here is exactly a commitment of that sort. In this community we're imagining, it seems to me, it'll be a very natural movement for people to begin to use their words to communicate their beliefs and their desires in this commissive fashion by means of avowing them. Okay, now that raises just one final question before going on to the next section. I said that I make my words expensive by shutting down, manifestly foreclosing excuse A, the misleading mind excuse. Of course, it would be even better, even more expensive and more credible if I could shut down the second excuse, you know, the changed mind excuse. And I'm going to call the act in which I communicate an attitude and shut down both of these excuses, I'm going to call it pledging, as a distinct from avowing. So pledging is stronger than avowing. If I pledge an attitude, I not only can acclaim a misleading mind in the event of not displaying it in action, I equally can acclaim that I change my mind. So can I pledge an attitude? Well, the interesting thing is I can pledge an intention. Why so? Because to pledge an intention is just to pledge to do something. If I pledge to join you on the hunt for the deer in the southern woods tomorrow morning, then I'm pledging in my terminology, an intention to join you in the hunt tomorrow morning. Okay, here's why it seems to me I can certainly pledge an intention. Assume, and I think a sort of story of coevolution will make it natural, make the assumption plausible, assume that that we have a means of communicating, whatever it is, that we're shutting down both excuses. Maybe it's a word like promise. I promise to be at the woods hunting with you tomorrow, or to go to the woods hunting with you tomorrow. Or maybe it's just, look, you can depend on me, I'll be there. Now imagine we've got a means like that available of shutting down two excuses, both excuses of these excuses. Well, the interesting thing is, just by virtue, given the means is there, I know that if I use that formula to you and say, I'll be there, maybe it's I'll be at the football game tonight or I'll be at the hunt or whatever, I know that I'm going to continue to have a powerful desideratum, not just to turn up, basically, not to change my mind. And what's that desideratum? That otherwise I'm going to lose, so to speak, reliability and reputation. I said I'll be there, that immediately, it's a bootstrapping sort of creation of an incentive to actually turn up when you said you'll turn up. You know, as in, I don't turn up, and you say, you promised you'd be, using the formula, remember, you promised you'd be at the woods, you weren't there, or at the game, or whatever it is, and I say, oh, I changed my mind. The response is going to be, what do you mean you changed your mind? You promised, you know, as in, you really put your reputation heavily on the line in both these respects, and you let me down because you failed in one respect that you supposed that they had put aside. You're claiming now an excuse of the second sort, the changed mind excuse rather than the misleading mind excuse, and that just doesn't pass muster. And so I think it's perfectly understandable why we should not just avow intentions, as often we do, but go further and pledge intentions, pledging to actually act as we do. And that's going to be particularly important in making ourselves credible, as you can see. Okay, final question then. Can we pledge other attitudes, like beliefs or like desires? Well, the answer is no, it seems to me, not in general anyhow, because when I claim to believe something, I've got to presumably answer to the expectation that the data support it. Otherwise, why would I believe it? Belief is supposed to be data sensitive, after all. When I claim to prefer something, I would say, or to rank it higher than something else, I claim that it's preferable, that I prefer it on the basis of the features that it has. Okay, well now the trouble with both preference and belief is that if I pledge to believe something, I'm saying I'm not going to change my mind regardless of the data. But that means it's not a belief I'm pledging, because a belief is functionally required to be data sensitive. It's just beyond your capacity. And similarly, if I pledge a preference, no, I will continue to prefer whatever. Again, I'm sort of defeating myself, because it's not a preference if it's indifferent to the features that the thing has. Intention is different for the reasons that I've gestured at. Okay, so we've got avowing and pledging. We can avow attitudes like belief and desire, preference and intention. I think of desire as an umbrella term for preference and intention. Preference being a ranking of any scenarios, and intention a ranking of scenarios or alternatives you see as options, up to you. You can make one or other of them, and at most one or other of them true. So we said you can avow these states and you can pledge, at any rate, intentions. And this means that you, any one of us, each of us, can really boost our credibility with other people by, in this sense, putting our money where our mouth is, as I put it. Notice one way of reflecting what I've just said about avowals and pledges is that when I make an avowal and a pledge, I speak for myself. I don't speak about myself. I might speak about Jones here if Jones were here, in saying, yeah, I think he believes that. I think what he intends, you know, those are all reports about Jones, right? What I've done is I don't report about myself, except at least I don't in many cases, in the cases where the data and the desiderata are enough to help me make up my mind. I speak for myself. I assume a certain authority, don't I? Because I assume the authority of being able to speak to what I desire and what I believe in a way that is not vulnerable, so to speak, to the factors that might be invoked in a reporter's excuses, not vulnerable to having been misled. I claim to be able to say this about my attitudes, shutting aside the possibility that I've been misled. It's me who's speaking, you know, I assume that authority. And equally, of course, in pledging, I do that, well, I do that really in spades in pledging. So all of this can be summed up by saying words enable us, of course, that almost goes without saying, to speak for ourselves. Of course, enables us to speak, we all know that. But I think it's really important to see the importance of speaking for ourselves, each of us speaking for himself or herself. Then the question arises, and that takes me to the second part of the lecture. The question is, can we speak for others too? Can any one of us expect to be able to speak, not just for what I, he or she, thinks or desires or whatever, but equally speak for what we think, what we desire, what we want, what we even intend? And I want to argue that actually we can, in a way surprisingly, and that this is an important feature of our social life, of the sort of life that we human beings, creatures of the word in that sense, can actually lead together. The two forms of exercise where it seems to me we speak for others in a very salient way, I'm going to describe in two words. The one word I don't like, it sort of gives you goose pimples a bit, but I can think of no other word. I call communing. I think we commune with one another. And the other word is incorporate. I think we incorporate in groups. And I'm going to talk about each of those in turn. And in each case, I'm going to say that we co-avow attitudes, meaning we avow them not just in our own name, but in our name, in the name of, in my case, of me, but also of those who are taken to be spoken for, so to speak, in the relevant group. And I'm also going to talk about co-pledging, as in binding others, not just myself, in the sense of shutting down the two excuses, not just for me, but also for them. Okay, so first point to make, and this is what I do at the top of page 2 of the handout for those of you who are following this. Both of these activities seem to me to be instances of what people nowadays often call joint action, or acting on a joint intention. Now, Tomasello has argued, Michael Tomasello, in I think really his very important work on the development of language and morality and so on, has argued, I think, to my eye, sort of, who am I to say, I'm not an empirical theorist, but that really joint action may be presupposed by language, that any story of a plausible kind that explains why language might get going is going to require that the species in question practice joint action. That may be so, and I think it is so, and actually my account of rule following, if you do accept it in the second lecture, presuppose something like that, that because, if you remember, the story was that rules could become salient as targets to track and to follow and to remain faithful to, only if we are, as I described it, a master or apprentice species who know what it is to teach one another and to learn from one another, and that is actually a form of acting on a joint intention. But putting that aside, maybe some form of joint action is presupposed to language, as Tomasello argues on empirical grounds and as that rule-following argument would support on more philosophical grounds, I guess. It's still the case that language, it seems to me, enriches and facilitates the possibilities of joint action. And I'm going to suggest that communing and incorporating are actually species of joint action that are facilitated in this way by language. Okay, but just a word on joint action and what I mean by it before looking at those two topics in particular. The story I'm going to give, I suppose it's most like Michael Bratton's rather than Raimo Tuomela's or Maggie Gilbert's or those of other people writing this literature. But actually, I don't think I have to be tied to any one account. But let's work with this one for a start. It seems to me we act jointly. We act on, as people say, a joint intention. When there is something, it has to be manifest. Let me start from the example. We're on the beach, and there's a swimmer in difficulty. And we all notice, maybe because someone calls out, maybe because he or she calls out, that there's a swimmer in difficulty. It's a very rough sort of ocean. Maybe it's pretty clear. No one is saying, I can do it. You know, I'm a master swimmer or whatever. So it's pretty clear to all of us that no one of us can save the swimmer on his or her own. But it's equally salient to us, perhaps because someone has said, let's make a chain, that there's a plan whereby we could save the swimmer, let's say by making a chain into the water. So it's manifest to us that I haven't said this, but I take it this is going to be the case in joint action. It's manifest to us, meaning each of us can see that we each see that we each see that we each see and so on. It's manifest to us that we each want to save this swimmer. We're not indifferent. We're not just turning back and opening the next page of the book. It's manifest to us that we can do this together by means of some plan. Maybe a plan that's obviously there for all to see, or maybe a plan that's made salient by someone calling it out. It's certainly manifest to us that there's something we can do to form a plan. You know, like, let's talk about this. What can we do? And thirdly, it's more or less manifest to us that if others do, maybe a number of others, maybe one other, that can vary, begin to play the parts in this salient plan, then each of us will join in the plan. Now, in a case like that, it seems to be very likely we'll all just rush. We'll take turns. You stand there, you stand there. I'm the straight, you know. One goes into the water, you grab the swimmer, and, you know, people pull or whatever it might be. In a case like that, that's a case of joint action. What we're each doing is premised on what we assume, and assume as a matter of common assumption, others are doing, and we're doing it together on the grounds of a shared assumption, manifestness, that we're all together wanting to do this by acting together. So it's very different from, joint action of that kind from, for example, action on the market, you know, whereby people in the market, by each seeking to buy low and sell high or whatever it might be to buy low, are going to drive the price to the competitive level, you know, the level such that below it, the sellers go out of business. That's an effect, it's a common effect of each pursuing our own ends, each acting on his or her own intention to do well in the market. In this case, it's not that we're each pursuing an independent end like that. No, on the contrary. We are each of us aware of what we together can do, and we're each falling in line with what's required of us in our own part in order for us together to do that. I think that sort of joint action is very likely presupposed for language. It may come very early in the history of our species, as a matter of fact. I think with children, there's now a lot of evidence that children automatically go into it. You know, as in the toddler who says, you know, sit there, you know, when you're on the swing, you know, the seesaw, you know. A toddler, a very young child, will get very irritated with you if you get off and let him or her down. You know, they'll point because they know this is something that you do together. I mean, Tomasello has written about this. There are quite a few psychological studies. I actually think it may even be the case, this is a bit of a distraction from the main line, but I think it's worth saying. It may even be the case with some joint actions that we don't know what we individually do in order to do the joint action together. So analogy, you know, each of us can presumably tie their shoelaces. Each of us learn to do that. You learn to do that by your mother, your father telling you to put your fingers there and so on. But each of us now, when we tie our shoelaces, if I ask you, what do you do with your right hand when you tie your shoelaces? We won't have a clue, or your left hand. But we'll be able to do it, you know, because the hands work together. The basic description of the action of which we can do it intentionally is that of tying laces, which involves both hands, not just one. I think it's quite plausible with certain forms of joint action, say with children, that actually they're not really aware of what's required of them individually. They just have a sense of what they together can do, and they then fall in line with the part. Example, tangoing, you know, not that I tango, but I can imagine, and after all, as we know, it takes two to tango. If you got a couple tangoing, it may well be the case if I say to either of them, now, what do you do when you tango? And the person says, oh, they're going, first, I mean, and they say, oh, I'm not really sure what I do at that stage, but they could do it together, right? So as if the basic description of the action, you know, the description under which they do it intentionally and not by doing anything more basically described intentionally, is that of tangoing together. Joint action may be very, very basic. Okay, that's... Let me just add one thing more. I think joint action comes in many different forms, and I think the literature focuses too much on one form in particular. The form it focuses on is where you've got cooperative action with a single end and only that, as in trying to save the swimmer, the example I gave. But a lot of joint action actually has a competitive dimension built into it, and I think this is really important. Like I want to play tennis with somebody. We each want to play tennis for something we each desire, you know, the thrill of the game, the excitement, the competition, the putting in the hours, whatever it might be. But of course, we can each achieve that goal together, and it requires two of us, by each pursuing a competitive goal that I want to win. And as we all know, if we've ever played a game like that, there's nothing so irritating as having an opponent who, you know, doesn't really want to win, you know, who's actually as anxious that you win as that he or she wins. It's really irritating. The joy of it depends on your competing. I think democracy is like that. I think political parties, it is a joint action of electing government under joint rules, but it's got the competitive component written in. And yeah, that's a bit by the by. So I just wanted to get that notion of joint action on the table. Now, creating common ground, or communing, as I'm going to call it, this is one activity, I think, which speech facilitates. That's incredibly important. It presupposes commitment, and it is itself a form of joint action. What I have in mind is this. It's often going to be manifest to you and may certain others that you're looking at common data, so, or maybe looking at common desiderata, for that matter. And in those circumstances, a natural assumption is going to be that whatever I'm led by the data to believe, that other person is going to be led by the data to believe as well. Now, in a circumstance like that, it's quite plausible that I might say, you know, looking at the data and aware that Jones or whoever is with me looking at these data might be in a lab, you know, it might be, you know, looking at racehorses and judging which is the most likely winner or whatever, that I say something like, well, you know, that's obviously the solution of this equation or whatever it might be. And where I'm assuming that I'm not just speaking for myself. I am, of course, speaking for myself. I'm reading what I believe. I've made up my mind, P. You know, the solution to the problem is such and such. But I'm speaking in a context where I sort of take the other person into the community and I claim to be speaking for us. I sort of presume on having the authority to say for what we believe, P, I say. Now, of course, if the other doesn't then object, you know, and say, yeah, I'm not so sure about that, right? Then it's going to be taken that I'm going to have gotten away, as it were, with co-avowing, not just avowing personally, but co-avowing this state of affairs. Now, in a case like that, or it might be, as I say, with desiderata rather than data, it might be something like, well, clearly this is the appealing thing to do, I say. Meaning, appealing thing for either of us to do, or maybe for us to do together. And again, I'm going to presume, so to speak, on the authority to speak for the other person. And if the other person doesn't object, then I'm going to speak, I'm going to have succeeded in speaking for both of us. It's going to be like as if, you know, I might do it explicitly by saying, now, do I speak for both of us and saying, clearly, this is the most appealing option? Do I speak for both of us and saying, P? And I might wait on that person to say, yeah, in which case it's a very explicit sort of authorization of my words as words uttered in our name rather than in my name. But I just simply say, P, in a case where the other person is in a position to say nay, you know, but doesn't. And if the other person can say nay, but doesn't, that's exactly the same as if the other person said yay. So I can co-avow by presuming authority, as well as co-avow having, as it were, invited and being given authority to do so. Now you can see where this is, and you can see how we, the protagonists of my story, might have motives to do this, because after all, in doing this, say in the case of belief, it's a way of testing my belief. You know, if the other person says no, no, because presumably you're responsive to the same data, so it's a way of testing the belief. But it's also a way of getting together with the other person. If we have a shared belief, then there's a possibility of a common action that won't be there unless we've established that we believe the same things. Okay, so now most of you can see that this is really playing into the model of conversation in Robert Stornacher's wonderful article on assertion from way back in the 1970s, because he describes what happens in very much the same sorts of terms. And now here's a sort of plan that we are following, as it were, which is a joint action type of plan, which is, and I've spelled it out here in A, B, and C, focusing on beliefs now for the moment. One presumptively co-avows a belief, expecting the other to be ready to accept, like I say P. The other then is, if the other doesn't demur, you know, doesn't say nay, then we establish that as something, well, the word that Stronacher introduced, I think, and is now in very common use, we establish it as common ground between us, that P, right? Of course, he may then say something else, or she may say something else, adding to this common ground, seeking to build it up. And I may accept, in which case the common ground gets richer. You know, you get a shared sort of sense of the world now between us. At some point, I may, or he, she may say something, and the other may demur and say, oh, I'm not so sure about that. Now, at that point, of course, we then go to, well, it'll be reasoning, as in co-reasoning that I talked about in the second lecture. We go to other considerations and see, can we find further back premises we agree on and then agree on where they lead, and then we resolve that difference between us and again succeed in building up the common ground further. Of course, at a certain point, you may just break down. You may not be able to achieve that sort of common ground, and that is a breakdown that's perfectly possible in human affairs. But equally, we know in many cases we do succeed in building up that sort of common ground. The sort of conversation I have in mind here I describe as unbounded conversation. As in, when I'm speaking to you or to someone, I'm not sort of saying, well, we guys believe this. You know, I think anyone should believe this if the data are persuasive. And it's sort of unbounded in that sense. Indeed, you could carry on this sort of conversation when you write a book, you know. When you say something, you know, you're inviting your reader to go along, so to speak, or to protest, you know, in the review or the critique or in further conversation. I think this is the sense of conversation. It's a metaphor, of course, but I still like it that people use when they talk about the conversation of mankind, like Richard Rorty in particular, the ongoing sort of conversation. I think disciplines have conversations of this kind, actually, but that's now... The important point is that in this sort of unbounded conversation about matters of belief, which we're talking about, we can establish a common ground between us. When I want to know what Jones believes, I don't have to read his mind, you know, in the phrase that is often used nowadays. I don't have to do any mind reading. We're creating the common ground between us. You know, it's from there to here and to here. We each know what we believe given the data. This sort of communing, I think, can go on with desiderata as well. The desiderata are very different because, of course, desiderata can be agent relative, as we know, as well as agent neutral. So the desiderata that matter to me may not be what matter to Jones in many areas, but in some areas they will be, you know, as in we've got common interests or whatever. And we can again commune about what we are seeking together. This communing I've talked about in unbounded conversation extends, of course, to groups where the group is closed. You know, we're, let's suppose, a political party. You know, we want to get common beliefs together. Maybe some of us will compromise in order to come to common beliefs with others. Or maybe it's a religious group, you know, where we're not bounded by the numbers, so to speak, in the group, but bounded by, well, there are certain doctrines we're just not going to question. We might look for community there. Those are sort of, I want to say that they're very important cases, but from my point of view, I want to just put them aside a little bit. But I just want to focus on this, that we have this amazing capacity, each of us, to speak for one another in this ongoing way, reading off, so to speak, attitudes that we share, individual attitudes that we share, whether of belief or of desire. And that's going to be incredibly important when it comes to, say, common action of further kinds, like, you know, I say that the deer are assembling on the other side of the wood. He doesn't demur. That's common ground between us. Good day for hunting, he says. Common ground between us, you know. I say something like, you know, Kelly would be great if we could get him along to join us. Common ground between us. And you can see how I can build up to actually we get going. But it's only on the basis of building up that common ground between us that we can do that. So communing in that way, Hobbes actually talks a lot about this, but he says that union is possible between human beings, whereas only concord is possible between animals. Now, this is maybe contentious in various ways, but he signals there's a very special way in which I think human beings can come together, know one another's minds, form common ground, know where they stand vis-a-vis one another, and it's not just speculative mind reading from one to the other. The other topic I wanted to mention is incorporation. In the case of communing, we're creating common ground that each of us individually shares. In the case of incorporation, what we do is this. Let me describe the aim or the project in abstract terms, first of all. We know from the first lecture again that what is it to be an agent? It's to be a system. I mean, this is my proposed definition. It's to be a system that has certain purposes established, that pursues these purposes across varying scenarios, and that therefore in each scenario has to register something about the scenario to determine what action to take in order to pursue the purpose in a way that suited to that scenario might be not be suited to others, which is another way of saying, a long-winded way of saying, that an agent is a system that pursues certain purposes according to certain representations, in accordance with representations of the environment in which it's behaving, or at least it does so when things are going well. Now, there's no reason, if that's what an agent is, there's no reason in principle why human beings might not get together to constitute a group agent, to, as a group, constitute an agent. If we, as a group, could agree on certain purposes. Maybe it's establishing, pursuing a certain environmental agenda, let's suppose, in Oxford. We assemble now, okay, thus we get various purposes, maybe some sub-purposes together, and then we try to form a common mind, as you might put it, on what the sub-goals are, what the order of priority among these goals is, what the circumstances are that make one or another strategy of action the most appropriate in pursuit of those purposes, and even who is supposed to play what part in advancing those purposes. If you really had a plan that we all stuck to in advancing these very general purposes across very different scenarios, and presumably the plan would have to involve establishing what we believe now and desire now, but also establishing how that set of attitudes should change in the light of new evidence, in the light of new opportunities. Not that we decide that in advance, but we have a mode of decision making that will mean that should evidence change, there'll be an automatic way, a more or less automatic way, of determining what we together should change in our attitudes and what different actions we should take. In that case, we as a group would be pursuing purposes according to, reliably presumably, according to more or less reliably formed attitudes, that's to say, in particular, representations of how best to pursue those purposes. Now, the one question is, how might people ever find a way of joint action that would enable them to constitute an agent in this sense. By the way, just notice that a single joint action, like saving the swimmer on the beach, doesn't make us into an agent in this sense, because of course it's purely episodic. You know, it's a particular goal, we organize to form that goal. In order to form a group agent, you've got to establish a mode of organization that will determine for any scenario the representations, the judgments that the body is going to make endorse in that scenario, and judgments about what the proper actions to take are in light of those changed representations or whatever, or perhaps changed purposes for that matter. So now, what plan might get us to form a group agent like that? Well, Hobbes had a very straightforward answer, and he's surely right about this. In fact, it turns out he was drawing on a lot of the medieval literature on corporations, as they, or universitates, as they were called in the medieval literature. And what he says is this: well, one simple way would be you make a spokesperson, one person. Maybe make me, Pettit, you know, is going to be the spokesperson for all you lot and this agenda stuff. So all I do now is I say, these are our purposes. Speaking with authority for you, co-avowing those purposes for you. And these are the things, the assumptions on which we're going to act, co-avowing, so to speak, our beliefs qua group agent. And then maybe I get right down to saying what each one of us is to do, etc. In that sense, co-avowing and indeed co-pledging various sorts of actions on behalf of you. And so when someone asks me, the spokesperson, the dictator as it is, what does your group think? And I say, what we believe is we stand for this and we're pursuing these purposes and these are the assumptions we're acting on, the representations and so on. When I say that, I speak with authority for us as a group in the way in which the individual may speak with authority in avowing and pledging his or her own attitudes. It's not as if I've consulted you guys and hey, I'm reporting what... No, no. I'm assuming an authority in virtue of my appointment, to speak for all of you. Now, of course, the dictatorial group agent is a very uninteresting one. In fact, you mightn't regard it as a group agent at all. You might say it's not a group agent, it's really Pettit with extended, you know, arms and legs and means of power, so to speak. It's just him in a fancy dress. Group agency proper, and Hobbes himself recognizes this, is going to involve not a single spokesperson, but, as he would have put it, he didn't quite put it like this, the creation of a single voice, you know, on any issue, such that we will all rally behind that voice. It will be a voice that speaks with authority for us. We will act as it requires us individually to act, and insofar as that's true, we can also act as a group agent. The voice will, as it were, give expression to the group mind being generated by whatever processes. Now, Hobbes himself thought that the process for generating a group mind of a non-dictatorial sort was just to take a majority vote on each issue as it comes up. That was a very bad proposal, and even though it's endorsed in a lot of the literature, and it gives rise to a problem I once described as the discursive dilemma, which I really lifted over from literature about law. And it goes like this. Suppose that we have Chris and John and I, here figuring as A, B, and C, suppose that we form a group agent and we decide to generate our representations by majority voting. Well, in many cases, there are going to be issues that are connected with one another. Each issue will be determined by majority voting on that issue. So the following is entirely possible. We can talk about examples if you'd like in the Q&A. P comes up, and there's John in the middle and Chris over there. And let's suppose that I say no to P, but they both say yes to P. So P wins, majority vote. Q comes up for a vote. Well, Chris, on the other end, says no to Q, but John and I say yes to Q. And now, okay, maybe at a later time, maybe it's not so clear, they're so connected, but there are many cases like this possible. P and Q comes up, you know, the conjunctive proposition. Well, if we're each individually consistent, which is, after all, an optimistic assumption, we're going to vote not P and Q, because I'm going to go out and vote against it, having voted against P, and Chris is going to vote against it, having voted against Q. Only John is going to vote for it. So we as a group, by majority voting, are going to believe P, Q, but not P and Q. Now, there's no way in which an agent can act on the basis of representations that are liable to that sort of inconsistency. Now, Christian List and I wrote a book in 2011 on group agency, but it was built on an earlier result that we had tumbled upon, which is that this isn't just a feature of majority voting. It turns out that almost any way with the group agent of reliably generating, you know, a group voice and a group mind in a non-dictatorial fashion will be liable to those sorts of inconsistencies if it's like majority voting in being, as you might call it, purely bottom-up. You know, we each vote as we think is right and then let the view of the whole just emerge from that, the view of the group emerge from that. Such a system in general runs into that sort of inconsistency. And that means that if we, even the three of us, are going to form a group agent, we had better not work with either majority voting or any other sort of bottom-up measure. Here's, of course, it's very easy to resolve this problem. The three of us, for example, might decide on what you might call a straw vote measure. We vote on each question, P, vote, and then after each vote we ask, is that okay with what we've voted up before? We vote on P, first judgment, first vote, we say yes. We vote on Q, majority for, no problem, isn't inconsistent. But then we vote on P and Q, and it turns out that it's inconsistent what we voted up before, and at that point we follow the following straw vote rule. We look at the smallest number of propositions that are inconsistent, and we decide to give up on at least one of those, restoring consistency. Like, we might think about this and we say, well, guys, we've got to give up on P or give up on Q. And if we give up on either of those, then no problem in saying not P and Q. Or we've got to give up not P and Q and hold on to P and Q. There's going to be a choice. We're going to have to craft, so to speak, the mind that we as a group are going to enact when acting as a group agent. And the crafting of that mind is going to involve breaking with a sort of continuity with the views of individuals. For example, if we decide as a group we believe P, Q, and P and Q, then on P and Q we're holding as a group by a view that a majority of us reject. I call the straw vote procedure what we did the bottom up, that was looking at the voting, and then a top down, we asked, is the result consistent? You know, looking at it from the point of view of the whole, and decided not, and go into this second phase of negotiation. Now, I think there are many ways in which you can make up the mind of a group agent, and they correspond to different ways of doing a top-down sort of filtering on the results of bottom-up generation, if you start with bottom-up generation. The filtering might involve, for example, take a group entity, as I think it is a group entity, like the United States. They have a very strange, after all, legislative matter that generates laws that are often inconsistent. That's the bottom up, or have problems and so on, are inconsistent with the Constitution. But then they've got a body, they've got judicial review, the Supreme Court, that's supposed to look at the overall output and strike out bits that will restore consistency. That's a top-down sort of procedure, just like straw voting. In this country, we use more a preview than a review sort of system, as in parties, for all sorts of institutional reasons, are going to be very careful about thinking in advance about the bundle of laws they mean to put into place, and going to be careful about its being internally inconsistent, that bundle of laws, but also consistent with the laws already on the books, or else they're going to revise the laws. And these are all ways of not just doing it bottom-up. In all of those cases, what's happening is the group forms a common mind, but it's a mind in which each, so to speak, has got to play his or her part in enacting it, and perhaps informing it, many of them. But it's a mind that is not going to correspond with the mind of any one of them, nor is it going to correspond with any function from their individual minds, like a majority of them, or any enority of them. I mean, that's what comes out of the result I talked about, Christian and I proving about 2002. But there are many other results in the literature that actually support that result and that show there really is a major problem here. But if that's correct, what I'm just saying, the group mind is a mind that the members have to craft or create. And it's a new mind. It's not corresponding to the mind of any one of them, nor is a function of their individual minds. The group, as it were, acting on that mind, on that voice that they generate, is going to have a certain, you might call it operational autonomy from the individual agents. It's going to do things that maybe a majority of them actually don't particularly favor. And that's the dilemma. That's the cost they have to pay for getting their act together as a group agent. There's no mystery here. The group agent isn't ontologically autonomous. It's just the same collection as the collection of individuals involved. That's all it is. But it is operationally autonomous. So just as speech enables us to commune in the way I described earlier, so it enables us, and in every case there's commitment, you see. We're pledging to follow the voice, for example, individually. And those who speak for the group can actually avow, co-avow the views of others in the group and indeed co-pledge, as in I say, as the CEO or whatever, we'll be there. We're going to back you on this or that sort of enterprise. But you get this sort of quite novel development of mind that is possible by virtue of speech. This last argument I just mentioned, I won't say anything more, I think it's quite important when it comes to methodological issues about explanatory social science. I think the lesson is you can't ignore the level of group agents, whether they be corporations, political parties, states, or just, you know, small-scale voluntary associations, NGOs, or churches. You just simply can't ignore what is happening as a result of that group agency formation, because there's going to be a discontinuity of a kind that makes prediction very possible, very difficult, between the lower level of individuals and the higher level of these groups. Equally, I think there's going to be ground for arguing, but this is to anticipate the theme of the last lecture, that groups are fit to be held responsible for what they do in their own right, not just the individuals acting in the name of the group. Anyhow, sorry for going a bit over the time. Thank you very much.